Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 22nd. I'm here with Mark Strickers, author of Why the Democrats Are Blue, Secular Liberalism and the Decline of the People's Party. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tim.
Now, Mark is also has an article in the current edition of America, which is called King David's Legacy, Barack Obama's Debt to a Catholic Boss, which is based in part on some research he did for his book. Now, Mark, maybe you can explain who King David is and what does Barack Obama owe to him?
This King David was David L. Lawrence, the mayor of Pittsburgh from 1945 to 1959 and governor of Pennsylvania from 1959 to 1963. Basically, in the post-war period, David L. Lawrence was the most powerful and really the most moral of the post-war Catholic bosses. What Lawrence did was play a major role in putting and keeping African-Americans in the Democratic coalition and also, in a broader way, giving the Democratic Party a new path, a new goal, a new destination in which to travel, and that was racial equality. The Democratic Party before then had really been all about reducing economic inequality and helping the aspiring middle classes become middle class. And Lawrence had played a key role in putting blacks in the Democratic coalition and giving them a new mission of racial equality. So kind of two goals there for the Democratic Party, racial equality and reducing economic inequality.
You look in your article at two conventions in particular that were kind of key here. One was 1948, 1964 was the second one. Maybe you can just go through those two briefly and what Lawrence did.
Well, I was hoping to go on for a couple hours, but I don't got much time. What Lawrence did in 1948 was that he was caught betwixt and between. White Southerners, on the one hand, threatened to bolt the party and get out of the convention if the Democratic Party passed a strong civil rights plank at the 1948 convention in Philadelphia. On the other hand, he had citizen intellectual wing of the party, kind of the what I call secular liberals today, they wanted to bolt the party if the strong civil rights plank was not passed and go in favor of Henry Wallace, the former vice president who was running for president in 1948. And 1948 was an unusual situation because you had four major presidential candidates. Henry Wallace on the left would have been Strom Thurmond on the right, and then, of course, Thomas Dewey on the Republican ticket and Harry Truman on the Democratic ticket. What Lawrence did was to play a key role in passing the strong civil rights plank at the 48 convention. In 1964 was kind of a reprise of sorts of what happened in 1948. Black Mississippi Democrats had not been able to vote in the 64 primaries. They had been excluded by the white Mississippi Democrats who were racist and wanted to keep the black Democrats down. And at the 64 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, Lawrence played a key role in negotiating a compromise between the black Mississippi Democrats and the National Party, some of whom were white Southerners. Well, this had all sorts of consequences, but I guess that played a key role was in allowing Lyndon Johnson to pass the Strong Civil Rights, the Voting Rights Act of 65, because from what Lawrence was able to do, he was able to keep a lid on what the black Mississippi Democrats wanted, and it did not alienate a lot of white Southerners. And as you probably know, in the 64 elections, the Democrats just crushed the Republicans. They had almost 300 seats in the House down to 130 or so to the Republicans, and they got a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, and Johnson was able to pass all these great society measures, partly because of what David Lawrence had did at the 64 convention in Atlantic City. Now, the details, as I was joking around, would go on for for a while, and this is why you should read Why the Democrats Are Blue. But
right, you've got your book, and also the article in America goes into a little more detail, so you can look to that.
Right.
Now, you mentioned, interestingly, that Lawrence was among the most moral of Catholic bosses, which kind of leads to my next question. I mean, why did he act the way he did? Was he purely interested in just kind of keeping his party intact, or was there something else at play here? Were there higher ideals that he was aspiring to?
He was acting from both motives. He was both a moral actor and a political actor. He saw black civil rights as a noble cause, one worth fighting for. In fact, in 1963, he gave a speech, I believe, in Cleveland, in which he equated the civil rights cause with the cause of early Christians. And I think he might even compared Martin Luther King to St. Paul as a great figure that Americans needed to support. He was raised to be a moral child. I was coming across one of his biographies, and his mother said, "I want my child to have a living, to be able to support his family, and also be a very moral person, as opposed to, say, just be an educated person or something like that." She was a devout Catholic, Lawrence's mother. But also, of course, and he went to Catholic schools up through 10th grade, and he interned, he was an assistant to this old labor lawyer, William Brennan, who was in the homestead strikes of the early 1890s. And Lawrence learned a lot from there and how to be a great politician, specifically the art of compromise and how to negotiate with people and broker interests. And Lawrence recognized that after the war, that blacks were filling into the big northern cities, partly because of the great black migration. And Lawrence saw that these black voters needed a voice, and that if the Democrats didn't get these folks, Republicans would. So it was both.
As you mentioned in your article and in your book, he was not the only Catholic boss who helped secure this. There were others, including John Bailey in Connecticut. Maybe you can mention some of those folks.
Right. John Bailey was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 1961 to 68. He had gotten the job when he had supported John F. Kennedy's campaign in 1960. He was a great figure in Connecticut politics and even in national politics to some extent. Other figures would be William Green, congressman from Philadelphia. Another figure would be Mayor Wagner of New York in the 40s and 50s. And each of these Catholic Democrats played key roles in reaching out to black voters. And I think it's a history that Catholics should be proud of and that should be recognized by scholars, but hasn't been.
Yes, you note that in your article that this has not been addressed even in some of the most comprehensive looks at this era. Why do you think that is?
Partly because it's backroom politics, and you have to be really interested in the behind-the-scenes maneuvers of what's happening at these conventions and do a tremendous amount of research, which scholars do, but the scholars have really kind of shied away from looking at politics. And that's been true pretty much for the last 40 years. That wasn't true of an earlier generation of scholars. And I just happened to be interested in this and came across of all the things that these post-war bosses had done. And I have to say that I'm one of the few who has done this. There have been a few other books on the bosses, but not really looking at them from a Catholic angle.
Now, in some ways, your argument is unconventional. I mean, there has been, much written about some of the acrimonious relationship between Catholics on the street and African Americans, and you're making the argument here that here's a Catholic boss who helped advance the civil rights cause. So do you think that some of these Catholic bosses, have to bear some of the blame for this antagonism that occurred in cities like Boston, between Catholics and blacks?
That's probably true. My book really looks at the post-war Catholic bosses. I know in that era the bosses had a very good relationship with blacks, and in fact very enviable and admirable one. However, not all the Catholic bosses, even in the post-war era, are great. I mean, Mayor Daley in Chicago, for example, was an ambiguous figure. On the one hand, he was not a great champion of black causes, but then again, the situation in Chicago was difficult. A figure your question is alluding to about in Boston, Mayor Curley, is also an ambiguous figure, someone who tried to support Catholic causes, but also didn't really care if he stepped on the toes. In fact, did worse things to non-Catholic groups. So it's understandable why the Catholic bosses don't have the best reputation. But if you look at the post-war era and what all the Catholic bosses done, and certainly compared to what Democratic Party leaders have done since that era, these Catholic bosses come out great. I mean, what has the Democratic Party done in the last 40 years as far as domestic social policy? Nothing compared to passing civil rights legislation for blacks, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, reducing poverty through food stamps. I mean, this is all made possible by the Catholic bosses who are electing Democratic presidents.
It might be useful for some of our readers to kind of acquaint themselves with the history that you deal with in this book, and that's, as you say, maybe not been written about as much. One is the McGovern Commission. Maybe you can explain that to us and what effect it's had on the current-day Democratic Party.
McGovern Commission was basically the vehicle by which secular liberals, you could also call them the citizen intellectual wing of the party, hijacked control of the presidential wing of the party. Now, that sounds controversial, and it sounds like maybe I'm running a polemic here, but that's really what happened. The Montgomery Commission was created at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago to democratize the party's nomination system, which was undemocratic. Hubert Humphrey, in 1968, the Democratic Party's nominee, did not get the support of a single primary voter. He hadn't entered for reasons having to do with the fact that Lyndon Johnson, the president, had resigned in late March of 68. In any event, this commission was supposed to democratize the party's nomination system, give a voice to voters in picking the party's presidential nominee rather than the bosses. What the McGovern Commission did, for reasons that I spell out in the book, mostly having to do with opposition to the Vietnam War and creating a new Democratic coalition, is to give the party's nomination system not only to voters, but also to activists, specifically in these caucuses states that allowed Barack Obama to win the party's nomination this year, and then the quotas for delegates. In the McGovern Commission, they created de facto quotas for three groups: blacks, or minorities, women, and young people. Not because these secular liberals, anti-war liberals on the McGovern Commission wanted to diversify the party's nomination system or get a new that sort of thing. They wanted to achieve a result. They knew that those three groups, women, blacks, and young people, were more likely to oppose the Vietnam War in 1972. So it was a political deal. It wasn't something nonpartisan, good government stuff. I talked to several of the people, Fred Dutton, who was Bobby Kennedy's campaign manager in 1968, Ken Bodie, who was a floor manager for George McGovern in 1968. That was their reason. And basically, the McGovern Commission did, as far as today and Barack Obama's, this explains why Obama has a big problem with connecting with white working class voters and Catholic voters. The party is just too far left on cultural and social issues. I know that many of the readers here probably think that Democrats have made some concessions on abortion specifically, but it really hasn't been enough for the broad mass of ordinary voters. And I think Obama is going to pay the price this fall when he loses. He's down now with these folks who don't trust him, admittedly partly for racial reasons, but also it's these cultural issues that the McGovern Commission unleashed. These secular liberals, the abortion rights feminists, this isn't politically correct. It's not something we like to talk about in the media, but I don't really see how any other way of going about to looking at this.
Yeah, well, that's we'll definitely get to talk about that more about what effect will this history have on today. One way we can do that is to talk about these what you call the Caseycrats, descendants of the former governor of Pennsylvania, Bob Casey. You write about in your book. It's been much talked about and written about the fact that Governor Casey was barred from speaking at the 1992 convention, but his son Bob Casey Jr. Did speak in Denver. Just this past August, and did state his disagreement with Obama about abortion. What did you think of that moment, and did you think it represented any kind of progress for the Democrats?
I think the speech was nothing, a whole lot more than happy talk, I'm afraid to say. I would like to say that this is a big, great concession, that Caseycrats are welcome back in the party. And it is true that the Democrats did move a little bit from their position on abortion by agreeing to fund, through healthcare, women who decided to give birth to their child. But that's all that the Caseycrats and the other religious folks in the party got. They didn't get much of anything, and I think that's just shocking, really, because Stanley Greenberg, Democratic pollster, has shown that Democrats' presidential nominees, Gore and Kerry, lost the last two presidential elections because they're too far left on cultural issues. You go to some of these Rust Belt states, these Caseycrats don't like, who are, should be both with the Democrats, who are with the Democrats on the economic issues, are not with the party on cultural issues, and forced between the Republicans and the Democrats, they go for the National Republicans because of the cultural conservatism. And I've just been out in Western Pennsylvania, and you talk to these people, they've got pictures of Christ there on the wall, and talk about how religious faith is important to them, and it's clear there's a big dissonance between the National Democratic Party and these ordinary voters.
So you kind of see, I mean, Obama, a lot of people are kind of heralding him, obviously, as a kind of a change agent, and that he's a new kind of Democrat. But seems from what you're saying that he represents a lot of, you know, he's not that much different from what's come before him.
Right. He's not that much different from what's come before him. I mean, give Obama credit as a black man who has won the Democratic Party's nomination. That is a big, big deal. I mean, it's clear that this country has made racial progress in the last 40 years. Not as much, obviously, as any of us would like, but it has made progress. And in that sense, Obama is different. But look at what Obama, his relationship is with white working class voters and just religious folks. It's nothing different from what has happened since 1972 when George McGovern was the party's presidential nominee. All these Democratic presidential, almost all of them, have had real problems with white working class voters and a lot of Catholics and just religious folks in general. Obama's having the same struggles.
But you can look at Hillary Clinton, and she seemed to be much more successful among those working class and Catholic voters than Obama, and that was one of the reasons that the contest dragged on for as long as it did.
Right.
So it seems that at least a certain kind of Democrat can appeal to those groups.
That's true. Bill Clinton did it in 1992, 1996. Jimmy Carter did it in 1976, and. You know, it's hard to say how Hillary Clinton would have done among those folks in the general election. Clearly, she would have done better than Obama. To what extent is hard to say, and whether that would put her over the top is difficult to say. But yeah, she resonated with those folks. That was her constituency. She seemed to move toward it maybe after the New Hampshire primary. So yeah, I guess one point I make is that the party's nomination system, because of this McGovern, the legacy of the McGovern Commission, and the fact that activists. Left liberal activists have too much of a voice in the party's nomination process that candidates like Obama, who don't have much appeal to the white working class, are more likely to win the nomination. And it's just a huge change from what the party had been.
Now, you said before that you think social issues like abortion, gay marriage, will play an important role in 2008. It certainly did in 2004, but the conventional wisdom seems to be that this year is different. The Iraq war, the economy, these are going to be the issues people are concerned about. But you said you were just in Western Pennsylvania, and from your impression is that these social issues are more important?
No, they're not. The conventionalism is correct. The resonance of the cultural issues in 2004 was part of the consequence of all these state ballot initiatives for gay marriage. And, you know, Kerry had been beaten up by a few Catholic bishops, at least, for his position on abortion. So those two dynamics are not as much of a factor in this election. But of those voters, so you're going to have some voters. How much it's going to be, it's hard to say. Maybe we have 15% of the electorate, maybe 18% of the electorate, probably less than the fifth of the values voters who went to the polls in 2004. But those voters are going to deliver their votes for the more culturally conservative, the two party's presidential nominees, and that's clearly John McCain and not Barack Obama. And so Obama is going to have to do really well on winning voters over on foreign policy and the economy because we're operating at a deficit with the values voters.
So it looks like to you that, the Catholic vote has been a crucial voting block for the last several elections. Do you think John McCain can deliver that vote in 2008?
Well, deliver, I guess it depends what you mean. I think he can probably get more than half of it. But look, a lot of these Catholic voters, for various reasons, partly the reasons of church teaching and partly the reasons that they become Americans and they vote like a lot of other people, but they don't particularly like the Republican economic policies and a lot of the Republican foreign policies. So, you know, McCain's not going to get nothing more, I imagine, 55% of the Catholic vote. Maybe probably just a little bit over half of it. It's hard to say.
Well, we'll see where it goes in 2008, in November. And I should say that Mark will be blogging for us occasionally on our In All Things, and also on our election blog up and through the time of the election. So he'll give us that his perspective on history and also in current events. What do you think? Just to end back with your book and with your article, what do you think the lessons of this era of the Catholic bosses and the fact that their legacy has been largely forgotten? What lesson should we draw from that now?
The lesson is that America needs good Catholic politicians. That's what it needs. America needs a strong religious center. Folks who were between James Dobson on the right and Jim Wallis on the left, America needs folks who are culturally conservative and economically liberal or populist, people who support we want to put families at the heart of American policy. These old bosses did that. These old, the post-war Catholic bosses that I discuss in my book, Dave Lawrence, John Bailey, and a few of the others, that was their constituency. Their constituency was just ordinary folks in these in big cities. And a lot of those, what has our political system really done to advance the interests of ordinary people in the last 40 years? We won the Cold War. That was a tremendous achievement. But we haven't reduced the poverty rate in this country. It's still floating between 12 and 14%. You know, abortion is legal. Unborn infants have no legal protection. They lost it 40 years ago. And the left and right don't seem to be too galvanized about either of these issues. And look, the Catholic bosses were political pragmatists, but they also had constituents, and they also wanted to act in moral fashion, and they were able to deliver some of the goods that working class Americans need. I mean, working class America has just been in decline for 40 years. Divorce rate, you look at divorce rates, inability to provide for families. Yes, they've gotten more material wealthy, but what's this money been used for? The Catholic bosses, if they had been around, they would have changed in different ways. That's what this country needs, I think.
Do you see anybody, to a final question, do you see anybody that can carry this mantle? We do have examples of some pro-life, you know, like Governor Bill Ritter of Colorado. So people who are socially conservative but are Democrats. Do you see anybody like that who can carry this legacy forward?
Yeah, Governor Ritter is a pretty good example. Governor Casey is, or Governor Casey, Senator Casey in Pennsylvania is a pretty good example of that. There are some examples. On the Republican side, I can't think of too many folks. Chris Smith, a congressman from New Jersey, is a good example. Yeah, it's more difficult to say. I mean, the new breed of Catholic pro-life Democrats are socially liberal on the gay issues, and that's probably an issue that pro-lifers are going to have to grapple with, whether they want a pro-life Democrat who's a pro-life Democrat who's friendly to gay issues, but also probably better on the economic issues for working class folks, or some of the Republicans who are not as good on the economic issues but anti-gay rights. So I see a little bit of a few outcroppings of it, and maybe this will come through Hispanic politicians or maybe some of the young evangelicals. I like to think some of the young Catholics are take up the mantle. I don't see much evidence for it, however.
Well, we will certainly be keeping an eye on that on our blog and also at America Magazine. Again, the book is called Why the Democrats Are Blue, Secular Liberalism and the Decline of the People's Party. Mark Strickers, thanks so much for making the trip up from Washington.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Anytime. It's great.
Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Next week, we'll have Father Drew Christensen, the Editor-in-Chief of America, who will introduce our special issue on the Synod on the Word of God, which will be taking place in the Vatican in October. A reminder that you can comment on our podcast by visiting americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Rudy for America Magazine.